This week I had a meeting with one of the leaders of the Global Orphan Project. It's a ministry that aims to help churches connect with the needs of fatherless kids around the world. The gentleman I had a chance to meet with is the coordinator of their international work. He works with churches in Haiti, Uganda, India. They're beginning work in Lebanon, and he helps local churches to care for orphans in their sphere of geography in their communities, and at times to connect churches in the United States, believers in the United States, with those needs and to help out in various capacities, sometimes just sending resources, sometimes sending people, sometimes actually receiving kids into their homes, into their churches. Its goal is not to just get kids to the United States, but in a tier approach, help kids proximally in their geographical setting, and then however they can as necessary with bringing kids to the United States, sort of the last option, but if necessary, that's their goal. Their entire focus is to work through the local church. And a friend had connected me with him, knowing we had similar interests, and they're based here in Kansas City, work in different places around the world. And it was a fun lunch. It was fun to hear this gentleman share a bit of his testimony and think about God's work in his life. He had worked at a campus ministry for several years and then began to work in a church and was leading worship. And he was in Miami leading worship in a church, and church was growing and doing well. And they began to reach kids who were fatherless. And at this point in our lunchtime, this gentleman was just sharing his situation of life and growing and where he's at now and how God had worked along the way. And he just paused. He slowed down. He said, "I couldn't get over the concept of fatherless children." And we're eating, and he just kind of said, "I just couldn't get over that." And it led him to have more opportunities with kids in that area and then move into this ministry of Global Orphan Project and just dedicating his life. He flies around the world many times a year to try to help churches taking in kids, and just the concept of fatherless children. Fatherless children. The most basic relationship, the most necessary relationship for the whole of life, obviously parents, and a father to guide and to lead. I couldn't get over the concept of fatherless children, that these kids had no dad. There's a sense in which we look at that with compassion. It elicits in us pity. And we should. We should have compassion. We should have great compassion. It should move us. It should compel us that there are kids today in Kansas City, around the world, who don't have a dad, who don't have a stable, structured relationship. They do not have someone to teach them over the long haul of life, to invest in them. That should compel us. That should not be right. It should not be the case that we look at that and think about it with any degree of depth and walk away and just go on with, well, what's the next thing in my agenda? It should stop us, and it should cause us to be involved. But not just pity. If we turn that around a bit and we look at this issue through a prism and we can see it through different angles, one of those angles is recognizing that men have given up perhaps the greatest opportunity they will ever have in life to use the abilities that God has put into every man naturally, to lead and to teach. Those are natural capacities in men, to lead, to do this, to see that something is done. And it's those capacities that lead us in work, that lead us in directing a number of ventures in our lives. And if a man gives up his children, if he abandons them, neglects them, he gives up an opportunity. So fatherless children should cause us pity, and they should cause us to have a quandary, if you will. Why give up such an opportunity? If you're a strategic thinker at all, you recognize that parenting is one of the most strategic relationships of life. I have an ability to, by the structure of my life, how I use my time, where I live, the habits I take up. What is more strategic for a passing on, a transmission of ideas through these natural leadership and teaching capacities? What is more natural than children? This week, I wrote an article, and it was published in ERLC blog, and I linked it in the update. And this is some of what I try to get at with pastors taking in orphans. What other job description in a church requires someone to have a good family, or at least try? It's this one. To teach, to lead, to have a loving, structured authority. And we've talked about this over and over, how you all are so helpful with us in that. And appreciate your attention today. I think that every week, pastor is one of the unique jobs where people sit and listen to just him for an extended period of time. What other job has that? It's loving authority. It's teaching. It's instruction. Provides so much. If I wouldn't do my job just as a pastor, do I realize the opportunity I'd be giving up? I once heard a pastor talking about his ministry, and there are different failures around, and pastors failing in this capacity and this one. He said, one of the reasons that keeps me faithful is that if I'm done, I lose this opportunity. If I fail morally, I lose my platform. And I want to influence people. I want them to know God. I want their lives to be enriched by Him. I want them to be saved. I want God glorified. And that is one of the reasons that keeps me faithful. I do not want to lose my platform. And if I fail, I lose it. It's the same with parenting. To abdicate that role, to let go of that opportunity that we have. And this brings us to the situation of every dad. And you who are taking advantage of your opportunity. I said this on Mother's Day, I'll say it today on Father's Day, and if you're a guest with us, hear it well from me. I think the ideas, the activities of our church that personally to me are the most exciting right now, if I were to list them, if I were talking with other people about our church, I would say amongst the top five would be the families of our church and the men and the women and how they are following the roles that God has given them, and they're following them for the right reasons. It's one thing to try to have a good Christian family. It's another thing when God is doing that because of His Spirit in you, because of a surrendered life, because of the truths of this text, some of which we'll be looking at today. And I'm so excited for the men of our church and what you're about and the patterns of life. I spend time praying for you, so I think sometimes 3 years out, 5 years out, 10 years out, sometimes you're in the midst of our lives, you don't have as much time to think ahead like that. I do for your family, and it makes me continually excited as I think about the results of the patterns you're establishing today. You are not giving up the opportunity God has set before you, and I want to pursue those goals with you. I want to be there when these opportunities come to fruition and we see the blessing and the result. And one of those is to think about the Great Commission, to think about our kids being raised in an environment in which the good life that the gospel provides in family, in work, in church, in structure, the good life is so compelling to kids that they recognize it is a result of the good news. That by the kids get to their teen years and beyond, they are connecting the dots that the good life I enjoy is a result of the good news, the gospel of Christ. His death, His resurrection, that teaching us that the good life we enjoy is a result of the good news, and because of that, I want everyone to have it. That is a logical progression. That's what I would want. That's the opportunity I'm seeing develop. That is my goal. That's what I hope to embrace with you over the next 5-10 years, and to see 10 years from now very fruitful. Kids wanting the Great Commission because they've had a good life and they understand that the goodness of their family, where there are relationships that seem to work, a church family that however imperfect works, it gets it. There's something unique here and it's God. That my life is organized and arranged. I'm not dominated by falsehood. I get a sense of integrity about life. I know why I'm here. I'm developing a Christian worldview, if we're talking technical language. And I understand that because of the good news, that this is inextricably, it's tightly organized. It's because of Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. That's teaching our family. And because of that, I want everyone to have it. That's my hope. So we have the opportunity, gentlemen, to continue to structure that. And I want to think this morning about this opportunity, this platform that we all enjoy, and the Great Commission. And I want to connect those dots. If you're a guest with us, this is not a normal habit of preaching. Holidays, we'll normally do a topical kind of message, important to help us think about specific ideas. Throughout the general course of our ministry, we preach through books, and we're in Luke right now, enjoying that, taking this week off for Father's Day, next week a special missions message as we send our team to Croatia. But today, just thinking about the role of fathers and the Great Commission, how this platform helps to structure the Great Commission. And just by connecting these two ideas, we have opened a window into three texts that we'll look at this morning. One in the Old Testament, two in the New. We will just stop at each text long enough to grab one idea while many could be pursued, and then we will try to rehearse again. Good life, good news, Great Commission, wanting everyone to have this. We'll begin in Proverbs 4, and join me there. I want to think with you about a father's role in teaching and this platform that we enjoy. And I want to think with you about the way that God has organized the structure of the family and teaching as the primary role of the father in a spiritual sense. We don't have to provide, we need to earn and use our gifting and all those things, but instruction is paramount in Proverbs. But I want us to notice that this instruction, by the way it's described, does not put you or me as the ultimate head of our home. Notice the text with me. Proverbs 4. Listen, my sons, to a father's discipline. Pay attention so that you may gain understanding, for I am giving you good instruction. Don't abandon my teaching. When I was a son with my father, tender and precious to my mother, he taught me and said, your heart must hold on, verse 4, to my words. Keep my commands and live. We've stopped at verse 4. The emphasis of these verses in the midst of several chapters introducing the themes of Proverbs, and second to none is this idea of instruction and teaching. Here in just a few verses, what is emphatic is the idea of a father teaching his son or his children, and it's father's instruction. Father Father. He seems to be head. He seems to be fount from which instruction flows. But notice the rest of this section, likely down through verse 9. Notice verse 5. Get wisdom. Get understanding. Don't forget or turn away from the words of my mouth. Don't abandon wisdom. She, here, another figure in this scenario. Now we have not a line, but a triangle. She will watch over you. Love her. She will guard you. Wisdom is supreme, so get wisdom. Whatever else you get understanding. Cherish her. She will exalt you. If you embrace her, she will honor you. She will place a garland of grace on your head. She will give you a crown of beauty. Verses 1 through 4, my instruction, my instruction, my instruction. It's a line. It's a direct connection, father to children. And then this line changes geometric shape, and there's a triangle. Now there's wisdom itself is teaching. Wisdom is involved. And if we think about the grid of wisdom in the Old Testament, the concept personified here in a female pronoun, the she, we think all the way back, and we have to Genesis 1 and God's creative work, because the emphasis of Genesis 1 is not just that God created by His Word, and He did so in a timely fashion, 24-hour days, we understand this. The emphasis is how He did it in terms of its quality. And it was good. And it was good. And it was good. And it was very good. This is wisdom. This is God's work. We could think beyond Genesis 1 to the Psalms. Psalm 1, Psalm 8, Psalm 19. These various psalms that bring together God's instruction, His creative work, and to think about wisdom is to think about creation itself. And to think about creation is to think about God. So it is not distant. It is not disconnected that New Testament writers would describe Jesus as God's wisdom personified. Because to think about wisdom is to think about God. You doing the math with me? In Proverbs 1, 1 through 4, my. After this, a bit of a shift, and in just 9 verses, a perspective here that the man is the teacher, but ultimately it's God doing the teaching. Here's the first principle I want to gather with you, gentlemen, in Proverbs 4, 1 through 9, is that we are under God. Under God. That our teaching is under God. One writer says, the stress on family-style teaching is developed here, whereas the attitude of parents can swing between being too authoritarian and failure to give guidance at all. Proverbs urges a third way, which offers firm teaching that is always under God. That He's supreme, He's ultimate, and we are under Him. Yes, God has placed us as the head of the home. The buck stops here. It has to stop somewhere. But let it be the case, and it will be necessary if our children are going to be raised in an environment that compels the Great Commission, that our lives are under God. As your kids grow, let it be the case that as they enter the teen years, sometimes they're a bit confused about you, just a bit, that yes, He's the head, but He is not ultimate. And it's obvious. I'm a child and so is He. He's teaching me and He's being taught by God. That, yes, I'm the head of our home, we could tell our children, but I am not the head of my life. I do not own my life. I have this ability, I have this gifting, I have this job, we're here in this place, but I am not in charge. You want to free your kids to love God and pursue the Great Commission? Make it obvious that you are head of the home, but you are not head of your life. God is. They'll be a little confused. And it's there they might get converted. because they see someone being teachable to God. I'm wide open to God, kids. I have, yep, the buck does stop here. He's put me in charge, but I am not head of my life. Yes, you all follow me, but I'm following someone. I'm a follower before I'm a leader. Joe Carter in the Gospel Coalition blog wrote it this way this week. Paul was able to say, follow my example, because he was worthy of imitation. If we want to be similarly watchworthy, we must dedicate ourselves to developing a broad range of godly habits. Above all, we must daily learn to trust and obey God in all things. These are not practices that come naturally to us. Developing godly habits that lead us to become like Christ requires vigilance and effort. If we're to be watchworthy dads for our children, we need to model our own behavior on imitation of worthy spiritual fathers. We need to be teachable, that is. We need to make it obvious to our kids that, yes, we're the head, we are the teachers, but we are being taught, we are under God. Second, turn with me to Colossians, the book of Colossians in the New Testament. I said we'd look at one Old Testament, two New Testament passages. Colossians. Colossians chapter 1. If you're taking notes this morning, we have suggested already here that there's a good life, good relationships, connections that we want kids raised in. And that's the result of the good news, and that's going to compel the Great Commission. And this all begins with the dad who's, yes, the head, he's teaching, but he's under God. That's the first idea, under God. Second, we get from Colossians, God is over all. Yes, kids, our family and me, we are under God, Proverbs 4, though there are lots of passages, not only in Proverbs, but the Old Testament and the New, that could lead to that idea preached. We are under God. But that's not enough. We want kids to be raised in an environment that understands, and God is over all. This word all is interesting, an adjective. And in Colossians, it's quite emphatic. In fact, in the New Testament, in the letters across the board, per word, all occurs in Colossians more than anywhere else. All. It can be used in different ways. It's an adjective, so it describes something. Sometimes it describes an idea in such a way that it is all without any exception. In other words, if there's all and there are lots of things, it's all without any exception. Sometimes it can be used to communicate the degree of something. In other words, all in every way, superlative to the highest degree. Sometimes the word all can be sort of a substantive idea. It's the all. And it doesn't necessarily have another word it describes. It's just the all. And Paul uses all three ways in Colossians. And he does so to communicate essentially, that God is over all. And because He is over all, what He has done in Christ is manifested in many ways. And I want to just notice a few of those texts with you here. First, let's look let's just go through some of Colossians 1 in order, and we'll sort of point out how all is used. Colossians 1:6. Here we begin with all, describing in every way, without exception, all in terms of a quantity. Colossians 1:6. And notice how this communicates the idea of God is over all. We're under Him and He's over all. This is the greatness of the gospel. Colossians 1:6. Well, let's begin in verse 5 there, halfway through a new sentence. In most translations, you have already heard about this hope, that is the hope of the gospel, and the message of the truth of the gospel that has come to you. And notice its pervasiveness, verse 6. It is bearing fruit, that is the gospel of hope, and is growing, verse 6, all over the world. That is, there's no place where the gospel goes where it's not growing. there are some seeds that can only grow in certain climates or certain soil. The gospel's different. It's planted all over, wherever it goes. All without exception. Any people group it would go to. God is over all. Chapter 1, verses 9 through 11. Hear this string of the word all. Several places this adjective occurs, and it's more of the idea of degree. To the highest degree, fully, in the highest way. Look at Colossians 1, 9 through 11. For this reason also, since the day we heard this, we haven't stopped praying for you. We are asking that you be filled with the knowledge of God's will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding. Verse 9, in every way. In every way, in a superlative way, all wisdom and spiritual understanding, so that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, bearing fruit in every good work, growing in the knowledge of God, every translating the idea of all. May you be strengthened with all power, that is, in fullness of power, may you be strengthened. May you be strengthened with all of God's might, is the idea. All endurance, verse 11. All patience, fully. This is God's power. God is over all. 1:16. Here, all is used in that third way. We've seen it in sequence. All without exception, all in every way or the highest degree. And in 1:16, here's an example of all as in the all. All of all. Here's God. Here's His supremacy. 1:16. We'll begin in verse 15. Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Verse 16, because by Him everything was created. The everything, verse 16, the all of all. All's allness. That's the way to think of it. The all. This is the vision to give our kids. So often we hear of kids who struggle with their faith at times, and it's true, kids are going to struggle and this and that, but men, here is the glory of Christ and its reality, that the experiences our kids have, what opportunities are before them, the relationships they might have, those avenues, those experiences, all of those things, God is over all. It's supercapacity. It will explain, it will comfort, it will encourage. The God who is over all and teaching our children of this robust vision of God, and I use that adjective carefully because I'm not making it something it's not. This is who God is. To talk about an exalted Christ is a bit of a redundancy, isn't it? Because He is. I often hear people, oh, Jesus, be big for us. He is. You don't need to ask Him. He is. You just need to submit and recognize it. Maybe that's the point. Lord, help me to be small. He is big. He is overall. He doesn't need our help to be bigger. There's a sense in which, yes, we want to know your exaltation. This will propel your parenting. I am under God, kids. Yep, I'm the head, but I'm a work in progress and I'm learning. I'm under God and I want it to be obvious. I'm under God. And that God who I am under is over. And this is why you're safe and sound with a teachable dad who doesn't have it all figured out. This is why, kids, you're doing okay. Don't worry about it. Yep, I messed up here. I messed up there. I have 50 things I could name wrong before 7 a.m. I get it. You could too. And it's all okay because this God who knows us is over all. Third, turn with me to Titus 2. Under God, over all. Finally, We are together in the church. Together in the church. I mentioned earlier that we would not do justice to every passage we're looking at, and I certainly have not done justice to Colossians and the ideas of supremacy there. Not just head over all things, but head over the church. Paul's special concern, not just the cosmos, as big as that is, but his special concern, the body, the church, and we are connected in him. We're under God, family, and he's over all, but we're not alone. We are together. We are connected in the church. Everyone around us is in the same position. If we get nothing else from Titus 2, 1 through 10, it's recognizing that there is no such thing as an island-dwelling Christian. That is an oxymoron. Rather, we're all together. We are together, older and younger. Just skim the text with me. You must speak, verse 1, was consistent with sound teaching. Older men, self-controlled, worthy respect, sensible, sound in faith, in love, endurance. Older men, verse 2. Verse 3, in the same way. That is, in the same way, older women. This quality of life that is going to be consistent through all of these groups is coordinated by the gospel. It's the same gospel working itself out in different ways, different relationships, different roles. Same gospel leading older men, a sense of sensibility dominates, and older women, a similar sensibility, but being played out in some specific roles. In the same way, older women, reverent in behavior, not slanders, not addicted to much wine. And they are to teach what is good, verse 3. It's this communication of one generation to the next. So they may encourage the young women to love their husbands and children, be sensible, pure, good homemakers. Doesn't the sequence of verses 3, 4, and 5 just excite you? It's one generation to another passing on. This is what I was made to do. I was made to see them take up this idea, take up this habit. Likewise, verse 6, encourage young men to be sensible. This is Titus' personal work. Titus, you do this. About everything, set an example of good works yourself. Integrity, dignity, the soundness of your message. Titus having a role in this matrix of the church. Those who are household servants, slaves by nature, were those carrying on in a submissive fashion. In all of this, verse 11, for the grace of God has appeared. Here's why. All of the ideas, the relationships, the qualities of those relationships in verses 1 through 10 are grounded in the grace of God that has appeared with salvation for all people. And the all people here in the sequence of verses 1 through 10 is each kind of group. Each one gets a measure of how it should live because of the gospel. This group, this group, this group, this group. And the idea is the gospel unites them all together. It's the gospel, it's the common bond, knitting together someone who is in their 60s and someone who is 6 years old. Someone who is in their teens and someone who is at retirement age. All together in the gospel. This is why we do our small groups purposefully, multi-age. This is why we try to have things coordinated together. We celebrate kids when they have activities. We do that as a church. I know, kids, I know that there are people in this room who regularly pray for you. You are not even 20. You're not an adult. I know they regularly pray for you. They want to be involved. They want to continue to care. They want to see you succeed. How many times I've seen this and just been blown away by the personal care of people who are older in church, caring even for my kids, looking out for them. Care packages at college, unsolicited. The kindness of those kinds of things. Tea parties for my daughters, doing this or that, this activity. Taking my son to go work with them for a few days when he was a teenager, just to learn. Just this morning, we're getting ready to come to church. And one of our girls grabs a stuffed animal. I don't know about you parents, but you got little kids. They want to bring everything to church. You'd have to get a U-Haul. And if we have multiple, and I got a girl, I mean, trust me. I'm not always popular on Sunday morning before church because I'm saying no a lot, right? I want to just get there and get to work, please. Well, this morning when it comes out, did you ask Mom if you could bring that? Yeah, Dad, I'm bringing it for VBS. I'm bringing it because the teacher asked me to bring it. She knew I had this doll because I brought it before, and they asked me to bring it so I could participate. Darkness flees at the light. Together, should naturally be the case that teens feel what older adults feel. If there is a sickness, teens, you should be concerned for the sickness of an older adult in our church. It should bother you. It should lead you to pray, to help to be concerned in some way. Older adults should continue to be concerned about kids. Where are they at? What do they need in life? What could I do to help them? What about this kid? What could I do to participate and help? We're together. And Dad's part of our role is to structure that, to have people of another generation over to our home, to involve them in our lives, to structure those kinds of relationships, share about our kids, so that we can begin to weave together these kinds of relationships. And one of the reasons, and we'll get to the Great Commission just ever so quickly, is here's why. Research over youth ministry, and I've read a good bit of this just in the last couple of months, showing that there's been this swing in about the last 40 years in evangelicalism. More churches about 30, 40 years ago, youth group. We need a youth group. We need, and I'm not saying anything categorically about these ideas, but just generally the research shows youth group, we need this youth group, we need to entertain, we need to have them off, have their own stuff, more programs for these kids, but recognize that many of those kids never really come to a true faith in Christ and continue on in their life. It just doesn't happen. They're there for a bit, they're entertained, they're on the roll, they're a number, so it looks good objectively from an elder board or something, but 10 years from now, there's no record there involved in the gospel at all, or a local church. But one of the factors that researchers have traced of those kids who stay involved in the gospel and are in a local church after their youth years, after their teen years, is that those kids, when they were in their teen years, had multiple relationships with multiple generations in their local church. They were involved, not just new names, but had common events, common meals, common schedules with people who were older than them. Not just in their own family line, but outside of it. Together toward the gospel. So, dads, we are positioned to compel the Great Commission. And again, here's, I think, how it works. The gospel gives us good lives, and I'm excited, men, about the life God's given you, the opportunities that you have, the structures from what I see. Now, none of us are perfect. We've all got a ways to go, but I think there's some structure in your families and in our church coordinating with that, and it leads to a good life, the kind of life where marriage works. It's not perfect, but kids see that God is involved in this marriage. There's love, there's sacrifice, there's forgiveness, and there's joy that people like each other. And sibling relationships where life is not dominated by their own desires, a kid's desires. Dad, I want 20 sport teams and you have to do it for me now. No, you're a child. You are not the head of this home. This is the way that they have some freedom, they enjoy, but even the things they want don't dominate. They're not the center. They get it. They're a part of things, but all that's because of God. We're under Him. And God is over all. He is the God who rules the cosmos, who created all things, and He's over us. And so we're in good hands. And it's this message of the gospel is why we have this good life. And over time, I'm praying and I'm trusting, and I think it's going to be the case, we're going to continue to see kids who recognize that this good life is because of the goodness of the gospel message, and it's so good, I want to order my life around it. I want other people to have it. Just as someone experiences something that gives them great pleasure, great strength, and they want other people to know it, they post about it, they give it away, that's the framework of life. That's what they want. That's my hope for us. And I'm confident God's going to do it, and I look forward to seeing it with you.